America's most shattered CPS-worthy homes. When one of her friends offered Gabriel a pill, Ashley said, "No, he's not taking any." But telling Gabriel not to do something only ensured that he did it. As they had, he crushed a pill, poured the powder into a soda, drank it down, and boom. Thus began a routine. Cranking the stereo, Ashley and Gabriel drove around and talked for hours. One Roche became two, then three, an instant good feeling, a cruising mood. Chatty, no worries, no shame. Ashley became Gabriel's Ruka, his girl. A steady date, but something less than a girlfriend, she dedicated the song Dilemma by Nelly and Kelly Rowland to him. The pills, which were used largely for recreation, not rape, worked differently on different people. Some became emotional and cried. Others went nuts, hallucinated, jumped off bridges. For Gabriel, the Roches relaxed and desensitized him. On Sunday nights, everyone went to San Bernardo Avenue, a cruising street next to Martin High, one block west of I-35, where the owners of customized Chevy S10s and Dodge Rams showed off their butterfly doors and Forgiata rims that cost more than the cars themselves. Gabriel would note who owned which ride, making a mental catalog of Laredo's biggest smugglers. His courage amplified by the Roches, he walked down the middle of San Bernardo against traffic. Swerving between the lowriders as they roared by, the world seemed harmless. Later during freshman year, Gabriel was walking in the hall when a member of a gang called Movida bumped into him on purpose. Minnie and Movida had played football with Gabriel in middle school. But Gabriel's older brother, Luis, was in the rival gang, the Cieteros. When Movida saw Gabriel hanging out with the Cieteros, they begrudged him for it. Every few weeks he cut his hair at Nidia's salon, Movida Turf. One day they saw him there and asked what he represented. "I'm not into little kids' shit," he said, mimicking what he'd once heard his Uncle Raul say. "I represent my hood, La Azteca." The boys of Movida said they had no problem with Gabriel, but now their opinion had apparently changed. That same afternoon, Gabriel asked Luis for the keys to their mom's escort so he could leave school and escape a potential confrontation with Movida gang members. As he walked through the parking lot, he heard people behind him cussing him out. When he turned around, he saw 24 Movida members walking toward him and prepared for a beating. As they approached, Luis, short with a hulking physique, came outside and stepped in between Gabriel and the mob. The leader of Movida threw a punch at Luis, who ducked and came back with an uppercut that knocked the boy down. He stood up, pretended to walk away, then turned around and slashed Luis's eyebrow with a sucker punch. After the fight broke up, Gabriel felt humiliated. He knew you never let someone else fight your fights and vowed to make sure it never happened again. Gabriel started hanging out with the Cieteros, going to their parties and looking for opportunities to be useful. The gang needed guns, such as 380s and 9mm. A Laredo cop sold guns out of the trunk of his car. He had law enforcement catalogs for the kids to peruse and would call them with news of special inventory. The cop, who lived on Lincoln Street, a block down from the Cardonas, even had grenade launchers and the flash grenades to test them. For more than a century, Laredo ran on the old patron system of political favoritism. J.C. Martin, the namesake of Martin High, was Laredo's mayor from 1954 to 1978. The original patron, Martin maintained power by stewarding immigrant-friendly policies for the mostly Hispanic city. No ID cards, abundant public housing, loose limits on welfare. Martin could make millions of dollars disappear into a city street department that paved only the road surrounding his mansion. He was corrupt as hell, but he brought out the vote. The poorest areas of Laredo, the west side, home to Martin High, south central, home to La Azteca, and the south side, home to the absolute worst ghetto, Santo Niño, were all bound by geography, the river, and the border. After the city's population doubled during the 1990s to nearly 250,000, real estate, still controlled by the oldest and wealthiest Laredo families, the Martins, Brunies, Killams, Walkers, and Longorias, remained some of the highest priced in Texas, which helped keep the middle class lean and lock the poor out of land ownership. In addition to the official ghettos in central and south Laredo, La Azteca, Siete Viejo, Cantaranas, The Heights, Santo Niño, Laredo was ringed by communities or camps called colonias. After World War II, developers began using agriculturally valueless land to create these unincorporated subdivisions without infrastructure or utilities, then sold the properties to immigrants who made low payments but didn't receive title until they made the final payment. There were no members at large on the city council, no one representing politically significant voting blocks. Each neighborhood, rather, was a ward with its own councilman. The councilman would build a community center or maybe improve a playground, then get reelected again and again on 100 votes. Not even the mayor could propose a citywide ordinance. "Almost everyone here is Hispanic, and even the handful of gringos are assimilated," said Ray Keck, the president of Texas A&M International University. The gringo son of European immigrants, Keck grew up just north of Laredo, went to Princeton University, married a Hispanic woman from Laredo, and then taught at the Hotchkiss Boarding School in Connecticut. "Since there is little ethnic tension, there's an easier, more natural system of subjugation, and the social classes tend to stagnate." Every school in Laredo has a colonia affiliated with it, and the colonia kids are bussed in. Whenever crime becomes a political issue, local media blame the colonias, depicting them as havens of depravity and filth. Never mind that Laredo's biggest criminal families often come from the upper classes on the fancy north side. Lagabi knew it, same as Robert and Ronnie Garcia knew it. When a kid from United North or Alexander High got in trouble, you never heard about it, because his parents were related to attorneys and judges. The wealthy walked away with a lecture, while the average Jose sat in the county jail. In the Laredo Independent School District, which contained Martin, Nixon, and Sigaroa High Schools, 97% of students were considered economically disadvantaged, and the other 3% just didn't fill out the paperwork. At Martin, the principal acknowledged that he fostered two groups, those who would go into the drug business and those who would chase them. Cops, agents, lawyers, judges, court workers, probation officers, not to mention diesel mechanics, truck yard owners, and warehouses that stored seized contraband for the government. The list of jobs created by drug prohibition was long. But everyone, it seemed, was mixed up in something. Laredo's council members lived on kickbacks. Judges favored dealers who supported their campaigns. The bail business was the biggest hustle of all. Bondsmen often split their money with prosecutors who helped recover seized vehicles and get their clients deals. For a fee, a corrections officer at the Webb County Jail helped arrestees get their bail lowered. The corrections officer's son was Laredo's district attorney, though the DA was never implicated in the scheme. On its high knoll, surrounded by coconut-less palm trees, adjacent to a huge port and a prized smuggling corridor, La Azteca, also known as the Devil's Corner, was magnificently positioned for a jack of black market trades. Immigrants, narcotics, cars, weapons, cash. Here, an underworld university, a brave and resourceful boy was a useful thing. One night, during the summer between Gabriel's freshman and sophomore year, the Cieteros were throwing a party when the girlfriend of the gang's leader screamed from a seated position on the ground. When people came to help her up, she said she'd been hit in the face by a short kid who was drunk. 12 years old and still under 5 feet, Rosalie Orreta worried that his given name sounded girlish. A fan of The Simpsons, he'd recently changed it to Bartolomeo. Friends and family now called him Bart. Bart's large family was typical of Laredo's poor. His father, a construction worker, and his mother, a beautician, both born in Mexico, earned a combined $400 a week and received $1,200 a month in food stamps. The second of 8 children, 4 boys, 4 girls, Bart was born in Houston. He lived across the street from the Cardonas and attended J.C. Martin Elementary until 2nd grade, when his family's house burned down. The Reta family moved 1 neighborhood north to Siete Viejo, where their dilapidated wood-frame mobile home lacked windows and doors. In the bedroom that Bart shared with his siblings, his favorite item was a Navy SEAL poster he stole from a local recruitment center. At night, when the family fell asleep together while watching TV, Bart would leave and walk to a nearby housing project where Seattle gang members gathered to smoke weed, drink beer, and play basketball beneath the 24-hour safety lights. Bart ventured out on these nights because he wanted to live his own life. He was tired of not having what he needed, of foregoing dinner on some nights so that his little sisters and brothers could have more food. To have something, he learned, you had to work for it. He was willing to work. He joined the Cieteros and became a favorite of the gang's leader. But now, at the party, Bart chugged Presidente brandy in the backyard when that same leader approached him, pulled out a gun, and put the barrel to Bart's head. Disrespecting a gang leader's girlfriend was grounds for a beating. Hitting her in the face could warrant something worse. Some of the Cieteros discussed taking Bart to a nearby field and shooting him. One gang member said killing Bart wouldn't be smart because the girls at the party would tell on them. Gabriel stood nearby, waiting for an opportunity to intervene on behalf of his childhood friend, the tough kid who always played football with the bigger boys and just wanted to fit in. Several gang members began to beat Bart, who tried to fight back but couldn't. Gabriel eventually broke it up and dragged Bart away. After that evening, Gabriel and Bart began to distance themselves from the Cieteros and spend more time with each other. While they walked near Gabriel's house in La Azteca one evening, Movida did a drive-by. Gabriel had been shot at twice before. He would hear the bullets whistle past and imagine the Matrix. Imagine that if he only raised his hand here, extended it there, he might just catch one. He would feel a chill, a tremble, and then battle mode entered. But this time, he was hit on the back and head with shotgun fragments. Getting shot, he now discovered, was different than getting shot at. He didn't feel the tiny fragments when they entered, just burning and cold drips. Then, humiliation, a tingle of rage on his lips, the unbearable feeling that someone had the upper hand. Two teens shot in drive-by, wrote the Laredo Morning Times. The cops recovered casings from the scene and said the investigation was ongoing. Investigation my ass, Gabriel thought, after getting out of the hospital. When he retaliated, shooting one of his rivals in the leg, it was a big turning point for the 15-year-old. He became known as a vato de huevos, someone who had the balls to pull the trigger, a gatillero. Most important, he now fought his own fights. People felt safe in his presence. His friends wanted to be around him. When absent from a gathering, people asked after his whereabouts. The respect was intoxicating. He started to carry a gun. His body changed. His bronzed, hairless chest was still concave, but his shoulders now popped. His lips grew plush, his nose straight and strong, his hands hard. He traded the Ricky Martin pompadour for the newer hairstyle, the M&M fade. Like any teenage boy developing a posture and attitude toward the world, a man's personality, cultural models imparted to him life's bitter realities and the noble ways of coping. In the shack next to his mother's house at 207 Lincoln, Gabriel and Luis watched Blood In, Blood Out, a movie about teen relatives from East Los Angeles, repeatedly. After the movie's characters get in a lethal fight with a rival gang, their paths diverge. Paco goes to the military and becomes a cop. Miklo goes to prison and becomes a gang leader. Gabriel understood the message of Paco. You can come from the hood and still make something of your life, but he identified most with Miklo. The heroic way the character stays true to his code and becomes the leader of his gang, the baddest man in prison, was an appealing fantasy. On the wall of the shack, Gabriel scribbled lyrics and poetry by Tupac Shakur. He took off his shirt, smoked weed, and listened to Hit 'Em Up, Still Ballin', and Hail Mary. Songs about street life and getting revenge. Tupac wrote his best songs in prison, lived the life he rhapsodized, battled dirty cops, and survived assailants. Gabriel danced and shadowboxed with the music. Five shots couldn't drop me. I took it and smiled. Turn that two-pack shit off, Lagabi would yell from across the dirt driveway, but Gabriel ignored her. As he moved around spinning, punching the air, his jeans sagging below the waistband of his plaid Tommy Hilfiger boxers, ideas sprang into his mind, principles crystallized into code. It was about being in La Punta del Cañon, at the front of the barrel. Be the guy who goes first. Die for the homies. Gabriel's close friends frequented the shack. The boys, Gabriel, Bart, and another close friend named Wences Tovar, known as Toucan for his mighty nose, plus a cast of associated homies from La Azteca and Siete Viejo, traded issues of Vibe magazine and followed every twist of hip-hop's East Coast-West Coast beef. Reading about the homicidal music mogul, Suge Knight, and the corruption of the Los Angeles Police Department, they saw their own habitat reflected in that celebrated ether. The music wasn't just called gangsta rap. It was real. Even more so when Carlos Coy, a.k.a. South Park Mexican, a Houston local, hit it big with songs like Thug Girl and Illegal Amigos. South Park Mexican, wrote the Houston Press, was a hero to the shaven-headed brown kids in baggy print shirts and jeans, those sons of yardmen, road builders, roofers, and dishwashers, the youths caught between two cultures but not particularly valued by either. SPM became a conduit for their rage and despair, but also for their dreams. He rapped for all the crazy motherfuckers. He let them know he'd been lost and needed help, just like them. That's why those who followed him were the sickest, most ill people in this world, because that's who SPM wanted to help and change. He dropped out of high school because he was tired of selling crack to your homeboy's mom and feeling like a worthless wetback. As a soon-to-be 18-year-old high school freshman, SPM also worried about going to jail for statutory rape. Gabriel and Luis used the shack to entertain female friends. On the outside of the shack, facing Lincoln Street, they hung a poster of a curvy Chicana lusting over a bottle of Bud Light. When sophomore year started, a truant officer found rolling papers and a bullet in Gabriel's pocket. It would be the last day he set foot in Martin High. 5. Overachieving Bitch. Ronnie Garcia continued to struggle in Laredo. The city was rotten with domestic violence, and she didn't need to be a cop to see it. After working as a receptionist at the medical office for several years, she took a new job as an administrator and recruiter at Texas A&M International University, known as TAMIU. Ronnie's close friend there was the mother of Trey's best friend. The woman wanted to switch careers and had just passed her nursing test when she told her husband she was going out to celebrate. He said no. She went out anyway. He met her in the front yard that night and slit her throat, killing her. The father got life in prison. The 8-year-old son, Trey's friend, moved between his grandmother's house and the Garcias' new house in Los Presidentes. On the first Christmas after his mother's murder, they were opening presents when the boy broke down. Ronnie held him for hours at a stretch, but it was hard to know what to do. She called her own parents in Arizona. "Robert's never home," she complained. "This boy is inconsolable." "Oh, quit it, you little overachieving bitch," her father would say, using their private rough language but not meaning it unkindly. "Slow down, honey. You can't be everything to everyone." Through tumult, an unwavering ethic yoked Robert and Ronnie to one another in a way that could alienate them from the crowd, particularly Robert's crowd. From speeding tickets to arrests, Laredo cops bent the rules and traded favors with the powerful. Robert didn't play such games. Ronnie appreciated his rectitude, even if it limited their social life to a tiny circle of cops and federal agents. At DEA, all the narcotics and cash and cars in the evidence room could finance a second agency. Temptation lurked, as it did at many of Laredo's law enforcement agencies, and Robert never knew which of his colleagues would fall. An agent might stay clean, but when his kids grew up and he needed extra money, he skimmed cash off a bust. When the money was counted, the arrested doper would say, "No, there was more there than that." but the doper was a criminal, so the agent got away with it. And that was the first step toward ruin, because if the agent got away with skimming money once, then he did it again. He might wriggle out the second time, too. It was always that third time when he found himself talking to a prosecutor and bidding his colleagues farewell. It could be an agent from a legacy law enforcement family or a father-son scheme. It could be an old partner, someone you thought you knew like the back of your hand. But then if you looked at the back of your hand every 5 years, it changed. The Garcias thinking, the system isn't fair, but opportunity exists. Don't be a freeloader. Serve the community, and it'll serve you. Get a job, suck it up. Get another job. Educate yourself. Keep moving. There was nothing political or ideological about it. Their guiding principle, rather, was a self-made couple's intolerance for laziness. The Garcias weren't religious, nor did they worship money. Respect and power, Robert had learned, were arbitrary and elusive. If the work didn't drive you, there was no point. He didn't hate guns, but he didn't like them either. Ever since Jesse's suicide, he had no interest in them. He would rather cook than hunt, rather weld a new smoker for Sunday barbecues than customize a car. In his garage turned man cave slash office, he stood behind the bar and entertained friends with football on the big screen and music on the old jukebox. On weekends, Robert spent as much time as possible with the boys. He and Trey wrestled in the morning. Eric, the stepson, resented their closeness. At 13, Eric had walked into Robert and Ronnie's bedroom and asked if he could change his last name to Garcia. Before Ronnie could answer, Robert said no. When Eric turned 18, Robert said he could do whatever he wanted. "You're being a fucking asshole," Ronnie told him. Maybe so. But a name, in Robert's mind, didn't matter. It was how you brought them up that mattered. As the oldest son among his own siblings, Robert never called his father, Robert Sr., Dad. He called him Beto, short for Roberto. This formalness had nothing to do with a lack of affection. It was about respect. If you wanted to raise a baby, treat him like a child. If you wanted the kid to work with you, to help look out for the family, treat him like a man. Sentimentality, in Robert's mind, wasn't a prerequisite for good parenting. For this reason, Robert intimidated Eric and Trey. He didn't tell them much or show emotion, but he had his ways of caring. While they worked on projects together, Robert asked the boys questions about school and life. The three of them tiled the bathroom and built a wall around the house. In the front yard, they planted trees and flowers and installed a sprinkler system. In back, they built a deck, an outdoor bar, and a new shed. Trey was the athlete, but Eric, the gringo, learned Spanish better than his Mexican brother and became a better craftsman. "You don't need to know how to do everything," Robert would tell him. "Just know what's involved in doing it so you know how much to pay someone else. Otherwise, you pay too much." To those neighbors crowding around them in the subdivision, Robert and his boys were a marvel of discipline. When neighbors alluded to hopes of doing similar projects on their houses, Robert would say, "You buy the materials, we'll come over and do it." Since he sent Laredo youth to jail on a daily basis, he brought a special vigilance to fathering. In this regard, Ronnie adapted her husband's style. Together, they micromanaged where other parents trusted. They had to know who the boys would be with, where they were going. Cell phone numbers for friends and parents. Pick-up and drop-off times. Trey complied. The younger boy was like his father, couldn't tell a lie if he wanted to. Eric, now in high school, was different. "Where are you going, Eric?" "Out." "With?" "Friends." "When you coming back?" "At some point." As a white kid attending one of Laredo's tougher schools, United South, Eric struggled more than his parents realized. His English classes were taught in Spanish. Boys dressed in baggy jeans and Scarface t-shirts, flashed gang signs, and didn't give a shit. Eric, not a naturally aggressive kid, was bullied, and this made him angry. Robert taught the boys to remain calm in the face of aggression, to fight only when forced, but it wasn't so simple. Eric's best friend became a father at 13. Seventh graders drove their parents' trucks to school. Eric certainly didn't wish to imitate all the debauchery he saw around him, but he envied the liberties enjoyed by his ungoverned classmates. To Eric, it was as if no one in Laredo were watching, except for his own dad, little Hitler. Eric, now 16, was smoking a little pot and doing a little drinking. His classmates did more. That year, United South expelled 14 students for drugs and violence and stationed drug-sniffing dogs at all entrances, earning it the distinction of a persistently dangerous school under President George W. Bush's No Child Left Behind Act. From the Laredo Morning Times. United South hugs the Mexican border on the city's south side and sits in a solidly middle-class neighborhood. But some of its students commute from colonias, unincorporated border settlements where impoverished residents live without public utilities. Without running water, some students come to school unbathed for days, said Dago Carmona, a drug counselor at United South. Some work for or are related to members of the heavily armed drug cartels in Nuevo Laredo, Mexico. It makes it hard on teachers because some of them are afraid, Carmona said. It's true that colonias contained illegal immigrants, but the media overplayed it. The biggest criminal families often came from those solidly middle-class neighborhoods, where immigrant parents spoiled their children to give the next generation more than they had. As a TAMIU recruiter, Ronnie visited the high schools and saw this phenomenon firsthand. She generally found kids from colonias better behaved than their richer classmates. In the best cases, she attributed this difference to the example set by having two working parents. In many families from the Garcia's neighborhood, and in richer families from the north side, the mother stayed home, but it rarely meant greater oversight. One fall afternoon in 2003, someone offered Eric a roche and told him to cut it in half. Instead, he took the whole pill and then fell out of his chair in math class. When security arrived a few minutes later, Eric was still lying in the aisle. Robert met them in the hallway. In the parking lot, Eric and Robert got into it, pushing and yelling. At home, Robert made him take three drug tests. Three. Ronnie returned from work and watched from the kitchen. Here we go again, she thought. The prior spring, when Robert was away on an undercover job, Eric had come home from school all pissy and flung open the refrigerator door with such force that he put a hole in the wall. Why can't you control your emotions? Ronnie had asked while Trey looked on. When Eric said, shut up, bitch, Ronnie, not a small woman, reared back and clocked him across the face with a closed fist. She kept the incident between her and the boys, lest Robert's reaction alienate Eric for good. Don't worry, Eric now shouted to his imaginary audience as he peed into cup after cup. Robert is on the job. He'll get to the bottom of this case if it's the last thing he does. As his stepson ranted, Robert thought, you never know what you have at home. The carpenter can be great, but his own furniture falls apart. The best mechanic in town breaks down on the highway. Watching Eric spin out of control, Robert wondered if he'd been too reluctant to let the boys make their own mistakes. You needed to monitor them and be strict, but they needed to go out there and fuck up on their own. The yin and yang. When Eric, still ranting, threw a wild punch, Robert tackled him, cuffed him, and ordered a squad car to take him to juvenile detention for an overnight stay. Had it been any other cop calling, dispatch would have thought it was a joke. 6. Underworld University. I begin my day at 5 a.m. as a dispatcher for a medical transportation service. Gabriela Cardona explained to Judge Danny Valdez when summoned to juvenile court to answer for her second son's truancy at reform school. Judge, I don't know what he does or who he sees. He goes to Nuevo Laredo and doesn't return until 4 in the morning. Back in 1987, as a young judge, Danny Valdez created the first gang summit in the Martin High cafeteria. The gang leaders would come in, shake hands, share a pizza lunch, and then return to hostilities a week later. But the initial hopeful stir the gang summit always created meant terrific PR. And the summits became regular features of springtime at places like Martin High and United South. Judge Valdez knew other ways of reforming bad kids. A week in juvenile detention, for instance, could help straighten a kid out. But since Laredo's juvenile detention center had only 24 beds, most offenders were released to their parents. Word on the street: all you need is a parent to show up and they let you go. By the early 2000s, as street gangs with cross-border ties proliferated, Judge Valdez now dealt with one of the country's highest rates of youth arrests for violent crimes. Gangs used to fight with their fists, now they fought with weapons. A youngster was arrested for a violent crime in the city, on average, every other day. But what Judge Valdez saw in his court, largely, were single-parent families going to hell. Parental involvement, he knew, went a long way. He tried ordering parents to sit with their delinquent kids in school, say for a morning or two per week. The strategy could be effective unless it was unrealistic for a parent to follow her child to school, which in most cases it was, as it was for Gabriela Cardona. For her son's truancy, Judge Valdez fined LaGabi $200 and told her to accompany Gabriel to his reform school on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. He also ordered Gabriel to attend the military disciplinary program, a weekend boot camp that enforced the consequences of delinquency and disrespect. Disrespect for what? Gabriel asked his homies back in the shack on Lincoln Street.
America way.
Way, literally an ox or a beast, is border slang for dude or idiot, depending on how it's used. The boys laughed. Laredo devoted every February to a month-long celebration of George Washington's birthday, but these kids from Lasteca had no reverence for it. The driving principles of America, they believed, were waging economic wars and plundering other societies. Veterans Day supposedly commemorated lives lost in the war for freedom. But what freedom, they asked. Oil had nothing to do with freedom. On Televisa, a Mexican TV network, they watched captured smugglers on both sides of the border paraded in front of the camera amid bales of marijuana and bricks of cocaine, money, and guns. Far from cautionary examples, they considered the handcuffed men to be pesados, heavyweights. 18 months prior to Gabriel and LaGabi appearing before Judge Valdez, the rolling papers and the bullet had landed him in Lara Academy, the first layer of Laredo's overburdened reform system. At Lara, a World War II veteran spoke about the horrors of war and the importance of an education. He described pulling limbs out of the South Pacific and confronting Japan's kamikaze pilots, who believed that to die for the emperor was to live forever. It was a weird way of thinking, the veteran said, but the suicide bombings on 9/11 were similar to the kamikaze missions. He concluded by saying that environmental influences were no excuse for delinquency. When Gabriel showed up to Lara Academy buzzed one Monday morning after a weekend of drinking, he was transferred to the next layer of the reform system, the Juvenile Justice Alternative Education Program. At JJAEP, known as The Alternative, mobile homes converted to classrooms formed a square around a basketball court. Students worked on learning modules at their own pace. For this stage in the system, somewhere between high school and prison, Judge Danny Valdez and the other juvenile judges who oversaw JJAEP struggled with just how prison-like the alternative should be. For instance, video cameras trained on the students were a source of controversy. Were the cameras advisable safety precautions or too big brother? Did they negate the sense of confidence and self-worth that the staff tried to instill in students? It was hard to say. Mostly, the cameras captured sex during recess and footage of the girl who gave out blowjobs after school. But the teachers and supervisors made it clear. If you didn't learn to behave, you would be sent to Texas Youth Commission, TYC Juvie, the junior prison that prepared you for the big house. When Gabriel tried to re-enroll at Martin High as a sophomore, the principal advised him that it was better to catch up on credits in the alternative then return to Martin and graduate with his class. If Gabriel felt frustrated by the principal's dismissal, he was also too busy with underworld pursuits to dwell on his school failures for long. Accompanied by Bart or some other associate, Gabriel stole cars in Laredo and sold them across the border to a man named Mario Flores Soto, known as Mame Flores, whom he met through a Lasteca family. Mame headed one of Nuevo Laredo's criminal organizations. Until then, Gabriel had only seen the money to be made from drugs going north. Mame showed him the other side, Mexico's demand for smuggled cars and weapons. From the 9mm, he graduated to bigger guns, like the Mini 14, an assault rifle. Uninhibited, thanks to the roches, which he now took with increasing frequency, ingesting as many as 5 per day, Gabriel stole cars and trucks with a methodical efficiency that sometimes dissolved into quick frustration if he felt a partner wasn't sharing an equal load of the risk. Having established a reputation as someone who was always down to ride, ready to tackle any criminal opportunity, Gabriel felt that others in his circle, like his older brother Luis, wanted the benefits without the risks. When Gabriel forced Luis to steal a truck from a gas station, his brother tried to pull himself together. Luis walked into the gas station, but then just kept walking, past the vehicle and into the night. Bart was the only homie whose fearlessness and work ethic matched Gabriel's. The day Gabriel jacked or stole a customized Ford F-150 pickup truck from Lasteca, Bart was in flip-flops, but he still sprinted behind the truck and threw himself into the bed while people from the neighborhood looked and laughed. Now, sentenced to the military boot camp for skipping the alternative, Gabriel, sleepless and still drunk from the night before, was determined to win the boot camp when La Gabi dropped him at the first weekend session. He forgot to bring his own water bottle, a boot camp rule, and almost passed out from dehydration during the marching, running, push-ups, and sit-ups. During the break, a congressman addressed them. "Half of you are not going to finish high school. I've seen a lot of good people end up in bad places, and we don't want that to happen to you." Gabriel partied again that Saturday evening and refused to return to boot camp the next morning, so his mother called the cops. A boot camp sergeant, seeing the police escort, went hard on Gabriel that day. "Get back! Get back! You're too slow! I can't hear you! Faster! Faster! Fall in!" The motivational yelling was thought to be effective because these kids lacked an authority figure. But the sergeant didn't want Gabriel there if he wasn't going to obey orders. He made it clear to Gabriel that if Gabriel wanted, he could quit, then go through the same boot camp at TYC. "Okay," Gabriel said, and walked outside as if to wait for a ride to juvie. When the sergeant went back inside, Gabriel ran to Lasteca, and juvie waited. After getting caught for a drive-by with Bart a month later, at the end of 2003, Gabriel finally landed in TYC. "We meet again," said the sergeant. After a few weeks of juvie, where Gabriel saw Ashley, the one who introduced him to Roches, now pushing a broom across the cafeteria floor, the probation officer cut the 17-year-old a break and sent him to rehab, the youth recovery home. But all Gabriel saw in rehab were drug fiends. He didn't feel he belonged, so he escaped. All the while, he never felt like a gangster in training, nor like he was making a conscious decision to go one way or the other. It was never this or that. It was always just, "Okay, let's do this." You get thrown out of high school and placed in reform school. You get thrown out of reform school and placed in the alternative. You get thrown out of the alternative and sent to juvie. By then, you are long gone, and the system appears to be funneling you from one stage of dereliction to the next. Nothing, it seemed, could halt his slide. In Gabriel's mind, this perpetual state of delinquency, bouncing between reform schools and underworld pursuits, led somewhere. His trouble with school was no proxy for failure. A militant work ethic burned through the fog of the roaches and shaped into ambition the energy released by their powerful effects. He ran guns and made money. He stole cars and made money. During slow times, he and a friend broke into an abandoned theater in Lasteca and stole boxes of clothes and other goods stored there by local merchants. When you found a calling, Gabriel believed, you devoted yourself to it. And though he'd never felt beholden to any group, he now felt as though he were drifting toward some entity that merited his respect. This activity with Mame, Gabriel thought, wasn't kid shit no more. No slinging nicks and dimes, no stupid beefs. Mame and his associates in Nuevo Laredo were serious men who stuck to codes and took care of their own. Mame's partner resided in a Nuevo Laredo prison where his cell had leather furniture, a kitchen, and a flat-screen TV. Friends visited. Women entertained while guards brought beer. How terrible was that? So when Gabriel broke free of rehab and sprinted through the onion fields of Webb County, kicking up clouds of dust on the way back to La Azteca, he didn't ditch the system aimlessly. He ran back to these enterprises, which benefited his mother, aunts, uncles, and brothers in the form of cash. His criminal lifestyle also meant he met new people constantly and affiliated with desirable underworld elements. Whatever dreams he'd had at 6 or 8 or 10 of becoming a lawyer, of wowing audiences with his charisma, well, he was taking his talents elsewhere. It was now 2004, and according to underworld rumor, a new group with a suicidal philosophy was taking over Nuevo Laredo. Some referred to them as La Gente Nueva, the new people. To Gabriel, one La Azteca hoodie, a homeboy from the neighborhood, stood apart from the others. Richard Hasso was the closest thing La Azteca had to smuggling royalty. A couple years older than Gabriel, Richard lived across the street with his wife's family. Richard didn't work for a gang, didn't have to. When he was 6, he started smuggling immigrants with his grandmother. At 8, his father took him on coke runs to Houston. At 16, Richard registered a ghost company called RJ's Trucking Incorporated. It specialized in shipping bulk loads of Mexican pottery and plastic scrap, which he could buy cheaply at the border and use as a cover for his marijuana loads. He shipped tons of marijuana to places like Georgia and North Carolina. He searched online for companies in those states that dealt in pottery or plastic scrap and listed them as buyers on the shipping manifest, the Bill of Lading, which contained a phone number for a female friend who answered in a sexy secretary's voice, RJ's Trucking. Richard purchased used Freightliner trucks, then stole permits and license plates from other trucks that looked like them. Instead of paying $8,000 apiece to buy cargo boxes, he rented them from a guy who waited 2 weeks before reporting the box stolen. By then, Richard had taken a load or two north and left the cargo box in some area where the cops could easily find it and return it to the owner. By 17, Richard had introduced roughly 50 tons of marijuana into the states. But marijuana was just a start. Now, at 19, thanks to a connection brokered by his sister's husband, Richard was adding a more lucrative product to his business, cocaine. Richard bought a new line of trucks, as well as insurance and permits, hired a full-time mechanic at $1,000 a week, and rented a warehouse in San Antonio, where he and his brother-in-law now spent most of their time. Richard transitioned from the hood chic style of Guess jeans and polo boots to the business casual uniform of DKNY pants and Steve Madden shoes, the preppy college guy look, as he referred to it. He offered to take Gabriel, who was still working for Mame, on as a bodyguard, errand boy, and courier. Richard represented much of what Gabriel wanted. He was married to a woman who came from a family of hustlers herself. Richard had partied in Miami Beach with one of his cocaine clients, a Cuban gentleman who supplied South Florida. In La Azteca, Richard told exotic stories, set in places like Ocean Boulevard, about being at the Mansion nightclub and drinking Cristal champagne straight from the bottle, while the most beautiful women you ever saw, dressed in the classiest clothes, made the air taste sweet. It wasn't bullshit, either. Gabriel and Luis, who also worked for Richard, saw Richard's setup in San Antonio. They saw how the VIP sections at the most popular clubs, like Planeta Barrio and Ritmo Latino, were always reserved for Richard and his brother-in-law and whoever tagged along. how Buchanan Scotch and Patron Tequila were always on the table, and how Richard handed envelopes of several hundred dollars each to the person in charge of security, the waitress, and the club manager, who made his office available for activities that required discretion. One time, when Richard brought his mother to a Los Tigres del Norte concert at Planeta Barrio, a couple occupied the table he wanted near the stage. Richard offered them $2,000 to move. A Volvo, an Avalanche, a GMC Denali, and a Jeep Grand Cherokee. Joe Brand, Versace, Hugo Boss, Lacoste, Prada, GBX, Fendi, Rolex, and custom jewelry. Family dinners at the best Mexican restaurants, with the mariachis playing requests all night. Richard lived a dream. He had lots of weekend girls who loved his warehouse of cocaine. The manager at Embassy Suites also loved him. The carousing led to fights at home, but his wife and kids lacked nothing. His mother-in-law, a friend of Lagabi, drove a new SUV. Every time Richard dropped another $5,000 at Toys R Us, the cashiers asked if he didn't want to adopt their kids. Gabriel noted the lust in the hood rat's eyes when Richard drove his Hummer through La Azteca, assassin chrome wheels glimmering in the sun like knife blades spinning. Even Richard's wife's friends flirted with him openly. Handsome in a way that was less thuggish than Gabriel, but somehow also less delicate, Richard was a gregarious guy with the magnetic quality of someone who made you feel better about yourself, whose beaming, big-toothed smile seemed to say, "I'll show you a very good time." In La Azteca, if someone owned a flashy car, such as a Tahoe or Escalade, customized with nice rims, a stereo, and tinted windows, people considered the guy to be se mueve, pushing, and he was respected. But if he had multiple such vehicles, he was considered to be se mueve pesado, moving heavy, and that label came with a different level of respect. In the eyes of the community, Richard was a model young man, a young pesado who was about his business. In La Azteca, to be about one's business was about to be the best thing you could be. Gabriel envied him. In Richard's employ, Gabriel's awareness of success expanded from trappings, Versace, Mercedes, to behavior. How did power act? How was it established, and how was it maintained? Richard had a business frame of mind. He was social, always on the lookout for upstate buyers, piojos, who could bulk up his bottom line. Richard made his aptitude for violence known, but left it to others whenever possible. Gabriel saw how carefully Richard formed trust, and how quickly it could be broken. Richard even accused his own wife of ripping loads, stealing drugs from him. Loyalty was fleeting in a world with such large amounts of money at stake. Richard, now managing operations at the San Antonio warehouse, made $15,000 a week, sometimes twice that. And yet he seemed to think that paying Gabriel $300 a week and covering the clubs was adequate. What about the loads Gabriel ran to Austin? Did Richard think Gabriel was too dumb to know he deserved commission? Well, maybe the next shipment would have to go missing, and maybe the shipment after that as well. In a traditional arm's-length smuggling deal between professionals, in which the Laredo drug supplier hires a transporter to carry a drug load to a northern buyer, it's quite hard for one party to rip the other off. Both supplier and transporter protect themselves with something called a letter. The supplier wants to protect himself against the transporter selling the drugs to another buyer, pocketing the entire sale price, then claiming that the vehicle crashed or that the load was seized by law enforcement. The transporter wants to protect himself against the supplier, who might be an informant, dropping a dime on him, reporting the details of the transporter's vehicle to the cops. In the letter, the transporter writes the details of the vehicle he's going to use to transport the load, seals the letter in an envelope, and gives it to the supplier. The supplier can open the letter later only if something goes wrong with the deal. If the transporter returns with a story about a vehicle crash or a seized load, the supplier can confirm the story by opening the letter and comparing the vehicle details to, say, police paperwork or a report on the news. But if the deal goes as planned, the supplier must return the letter to the transporter unopened. Normally, Richard used a letter with his transporters, but not with Gabriel, because Gabriel was an old friend, and he only moved small loads. And so, with his childhood friend Wences Toucan Tovar, Gabriel jacked 50 pounds of weed from Richard and pushed it north, all the way to a connection in Springfield, Illinois. He jacked another load, 200 pounds, and drove it to San Antonio. This time, however, the dope was concealed in a steel box inside the gas tank. They bought an electric saw and parked in a nice neighborhood. Sparks flew as they tried to cut the tank in half. People gathered in their yards to watch. When the sparks ignited the fuel, the truck caught fire. Gabriel scrambled for a pail and a hose while spectators ushered their children inside, but the flames engulfed the truck too quickly, so Gabriel and Wences ran away. Gabriel told Wences not to come around the hood for a couple of weeks. He told Richard that Wences had been arrested. Toucan in the pen? It was plausible. Born in Texas and raised in La Azteca until the age of 10, Wences moved across the border to Mexico when his dad caught a smuggling charge and had to flee. Wences moved back to Laredo at 15. Following his own early stints in Lara Academy and JJAEP, Wences applied to return to Martin High. The principal gave him one last chance not to fuck up. But when a sophomore challenged him to a fight over a girl, Wences cut open the guy's cheek with a punch. The guy said Wences hit him with brass knuckles, which wasn't true, but Wences landed in county jail for a few months, then pleaded guilty to aggravated assault and got probation. Word spread. Wences took a felony 2 charge, a second-degree felony, and walked away with only probation.
"Get a job!"
his mother screamed. Wences labored at Expeditors, Inc., a warehouse on the west side, but didn't like working for minimum wage. He cared about having enough money to own a decent ride, smoke pot, entertain preppy girls from the north side, and buy some flashy jewelry, the thick chains, esclavas, that were prized in the hood. Having lived on both sides of the border, Wences, like Gabriel, had a wide network, and they would need it, because their association with Richard would not last much longer. Most of Gabriel's social life now took place across the border. In the Nuevo Laredo nightclubs, where teenagers from Mexico and the States hung out, the hood rats beckoned, their sweat-soaked tanks clinging to their breasts as they thumb-hooked booty shorts and hula-hooped their hips to Daddy Yankee's Gasolina. They guzzled Budweiser and grinded against whichever baller's pocket showed the gangster bulge of a good week. The long-braided fresas congregated in the corner and sipped Boone's Farm, the bottom-shelf wine, while the rat waited for DJ Curry to announce the next lap dance. Purple strobes flashed electric on rolling asses. Eyes pulsed, teeth glowed. There was a cap culture among border youngsters. On occasion, Gabriel wore an L.A. Dodgers hat for La Amalia, the Nuevo Laredo neighborhood controlled by Mamé. Americans with a little money, especially those connected to prominent gangsters like Mamé, had power in the Nuevo Laredo club scene. Most Americans went to Señor Frog's, which was stricter on security, more of a hookup scene. Clubs like 57th Street had less security, so they attracted a more thuggish crowd. But as long as Gabriel didn't piss off the wrong people, his work for Mamé Flores, which had continued while he worked for Richard, made the clubs a veritable zone of impunity. One night, rocheted out and feeling untouchable, Gabriel approached an enemy at the 57th Street nightclub and said, "What's up, fucker?" This enemy was a former friend. But following a disagreement over a gun swap, the friend had become hostile, at one point sucker-punching Gabriel, then threatening his younger brother. Gabriel had trusted the fool, and now this. Nah. The Roches, having severed any last thread of restraint, he called the enemy outside and pummeled the larger boy to the edge of consciousness. It was the worst beating Gabriel's crew had ever seen. The boy was driven back to Laredo and airlifted to San Antonio that evening. Gabriel now had the reputation of someone who nearly killed someone with his hands. On the American side of the border, back in Las Teca, Gabriel's business relationships frayed. Richard Hasso, suspicious over the missing loads, stopped giving Gabriel work. Smuggling, Gabriel learned, was a tough game. The moving parts, the responsibilities. His separation from Richard was a setback, but he still had Mame, the cars, the guns, and who knew where that might lead. Part 2. The Company. The ladder of promotion was marked out in a straightforward, arithmetical way. The taking of captives in single combat and scored as to quality for presentation for death on the killing stone. Aztecs, Inga Clendenin. 7. Original Vice Lord. In the beginning, on a brutal morning in June, when the South Texas heat congealed in the sky and baked the floodplains, there were only the stirrings of a city, an inkling of identity. Were they American or Mexican? Should they settle on this side or that? Did it matter which Laredo they lived in? It was 1853, after America won the Mexican-American War. In the mid-1840s, James Polk had turned his political career around and won the White House when he perceived public sentiment in favor of bringing Texas into the Union. He continued the westward expansion, Manifest Destiny, by attacking Mexico and winning California and New Mexico in 1847. Now, 6 years later, after Laredo residents had been given the choice to stay north of the Rio Grande on what was now American territory, or move across the river to Mexico, a reporter for a new newspaper, the New York Times, came to Laredo and observed an American surgeon shoot two men in a bar. The surgeon fled across the border, where his captors put him in leg irons and shipped him back across. In Laredo, he was placed on a box and hanged. The Times reporter saw cattle raids and military encampments, violence and rough commerce. What was the effect of this demoralized frontier life on character? He asked. People grow used to it, reckless of life, ragged and saucy. The attention is called to getting whereof to clothe and to eat. The practice of carrying weapons, imposed by a few upon all, makes them suspicious and hasty. Since the end of the Mexican-American War, both countries had been expanding their legions of customs inspectors and border patrols, which turned Laredo and Nuevo Laredo into corrupt tariff-collecting towns. The mouth of the Rio Grande, where the Great River empties into the Gulf of Mexico, 200 miles southeast of Laredo, was becoming one of the busiest ports in the world. But Laredo and Nuevo Laredo remained trading posts, which meant that every new regulation presented a new smuggling opportunity. Coffee, sugar, bacon, and even cotton. When the Civil War began, European ships waited in the Gulf to exchange their cargo for the outgoing Confederate cotton that helped finance the war for the South. When Union warships attempted to blockade the cotton trade and cut off Confederate financing, cotton smugglers traveled through Laredo instead. Smuggling went both ways. Mexico's prohibition of tobacco, following its independence from Spain in 1821, translated into enormous premiums for American tobacco merchants. During the hostilities that followed the end of the Mexican-American War, Mexican authorities seized 565 bales from Samuel Belden, a New Orleans tobacconist. Belden petitioned U.S. President Millard Fillmore, demanding that Washington intervene on his behalf. Others filed similar grievances. Although better than what today's Mexican drug lords could hope for when their dope is seized, Belden's outcome was less than satisfactory. Decades later, in 1885, the U.S. government awarded Belden $128,000 on a $500,000 loss. During the second half of the 19th century, as Laredo developed new industries, oil, ore, and onions, the Industrial Revolution turned the city into a place of some significance. Bridges connected the countries. Railroads brought immigrants, French and Lebanese merchants, Swiss saddle makers, Polish grocers, Czech tanners, Italian hoteliers. In 1880, Anheuser-Busch established one of its first distributorships in Laredo. But the city remained a trading post. War and policy would always be hatched elsewhere. Laredo was the border frontier's petri dish of implication.